You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
This is The Brian Callen Show without Brian Callen. Brian actually booked a job today, and I really couldn't wait to talk to Spiros again, so I said, sorry, Brian, I'm going to do this conversation on my own. The reason why is because, you know, the last time we had Spiros on, obviously he's charming and charismatic and all of that sort of stuff. But I think Brian and I very much remained at that place where we were frankly intimidated. Not just by Spiros as a, you know, a physical specimen, a Greek god, you know, an Olympian, but also, you know, intimidated by the idea of quantum physics and physics in general. And I mean, when we had Lawrence Krauss on, the point he made was, you know, we shouldn't just stand in awe of physics. We should really get in there and wrestle with these concepts because, you know, to stand in awe of things is, you know, ultimately weakens yourself. And further, it's also just a cop out. You're not even really trying to engage with the stuff. And then we had the conversation with Spiros, which was, you know, Spiros made very much the same point. And then I've been reading this book, The Universe in the Rearview Mirror by Dave Goldberg, who's a physicist as well. And he makes very much the same point. And I think for physicists, there's probably a real frustration that so many people are like, that's too hard for me. Is that true, Spiros?
This is very true. Thank you for having me back. And I hope that this time we'll go a little bit deeper to also make things more clear and easier for the public, I guess, to understand.
So. Yeah. Yeah. So a lot of what we talked about the last time was the fact that what happens, you know, the way that we experience the world, you know, either through a Newtonian lens, the idea of every action having an equal but opposite reaction, or the way that we understand things intuitively, even like in a pre-Newtonian sense where, you know, we push something and it stops and we assume that things stop of their own accord. Well, what Newton realized was is they don't stop of their own accord. There's actually this force friction that is actually stopping it, but we don't, you know, appreciate that and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, these more and more and more accurate models, and now we're really getting to the stage where we're really pushing down to the most fundamental level, not just what happens at the scale of the big, but what happens at the scale of the incredibly small.
Yes, and we're seeing something interesting that as we're going deeper and deeper into the scale of the very small, the same type of ideas of how the very large things like planets operate and revolve around each other, we end up seeing very similar ideas at the very small scales. But then we end up seeing also some things that we do not expect just when we look at the very, very large. And that's where quantum mechanics comes in, and maybe even a theory that underlies quantum mechanics itself.
Right, which is the theory of everything, as it's sometimes called.
Yes, and I guess I said last time that even if we had a theory of everything, which meant that somehow we could figure out how to unify gravity with quantum mechanics to get something that we call quantum gravity, even after that happens, this would just give us the ingredients, right? It's almost like we're playing a game of chess, and then after thousands of years, we finally figured out the rules, right? First, we figured out like what the pawns do, then what the rooks, and then like the knight, and you have the queen at the very end that can do pretty much anything. But after you figured out how the rules work, it doesn't mean that you're an expert chess player, right? Then you have actually emergent strategies, the plots that you can actually write now that you have the words. And so we're still trying to figure out what the words are. But once you actually figure out the basic ingredients, then you can really start building stuff that you didn't think you could build before.
Right. So the theory of everything is the set of rules of how chess works. But then you have to figure out, oh, here's an opening move. Here's how in this situation you would win. Here are the patterns, all
that
sort of stuff.
And it's kind of interesting because even as you're trying to learn the rules, say as you're playing chess, but nobody has actually told you the rules, and somehow you start developing your own set of rules, right? And then the rules that you make actually make for interesting strategies. Some rules actually make very good strategies. Other ones just make the game very easy and very trivial, assuming that all pieces move the same way, like a queen, would not make it very interesting, right? So these restrictions allow you to actually create some more interesting strategies and plots. And then you have this interplay, right? You know, you're going back and forth between figuring out what the rules are, but also creating your own strategies that become more and more elaborate. And a strategy like that, without actually knowing all the rules, is kind of like Newtonian physics, right? You don't actually know what underlies Newtonian physics, but it seems to work really well, and you can play a really good game at that level. But you want to actually go deeper and figure out all the possible moves and what you can actually do with all the pieces.
Right, and this goes back to what we were talking about the last time, which a lot of it was about models.
Yes,
right?
That's right. So you want to start with something that will have as few equations as possible. And the key is to actually get rid of every equation and to come up with a model that would just justify itself, right? It would be almost like mathematics based on just two or three axioms that you could pick apart every axiom and say, okay, if this particular axiom, axiom number one, was not true, could we experience like the model that we see around us? No, right? What about axiom number two? The same thing, no, and so on and so forth. So they have to be self-evident from the point of view that the negation of any one of these axioms would actually give you something that has no correspondence to what we actually see.
Right, to physical reality.
Exactly. And you want to go even deeper than that because even physical reality is an illusion, mm-hmm. right? So you want to go to something that is more fundamental that says, forget about physical reality. What if you had any reality for which you could create a theory, right? Mm-hmm. Which means for which you could predict what will happen next. Okay, so even the concept of next is actually interesting, right? Because that presupposes some idea of time. Mm-hmm. And then you want to derive that as well. You want mm-hmm. to understand where the next comes from. Is there such a thing? Is there an ordering? Or is there something that is random, right? And then we bring the ordering in it. So some of these things have been occupying my mind lately. Yeah.
Well, these are good questions. And the thing that I think would be really interesting here is to say, you know, in the 1200s, right, you know, Thomas Aquinas and all of these guys, they sat around asking these very, very theoretical, heady questions like how many angels could you fit on the head of a pin and all of that sort of stuff.
That's deep stuff. Yes.
Yeah. But the thing is why is, you know, I think so often, you know, quantum physics, because as you say, it doesn't necessarily fit with physical reality, right? You know, Newtonian mechanics, I can in some sense verify, you know, in a high school classroom, we put a little car on a little track, you know, oh, we put it on an air track and suddenly there's no resistance. It keeps on moving forever and ever and ever. You know, quantum mechanics, because it's not in the world of physical reality, it sometimes feels to people a little bit like Thomas Aquinas sitting around and wondering how many angels there are on a head of a pin.
It's certainly like that. It's actually very difficult to create intuition about mm-hmm. quantum mechanics because you actually need a very expensive lab usually mm-hmm. to do something like that. Or you need to try to do experiments in a classroom using simple lasers and mm-hmm. maybe some polarizers that create interference patterns and then try to deduce from that, right? You know, just through thought experiments, what you would expect to see if light was a set of particles or if it was wave, and then try to understand this idea of duality, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the idea that the same thing can have a different essence if you look at it from a different point of view.
Right, and you're talking about the double slit experiment.
That's right. That's one of them, double slit experiment. But more fundamental in quantum mechanics is this idea that the point of view that you take as an observer mm-hmm. actually changes what you observe.
Right. Can you break that down for us? Because that's one of those things that often gets floated around in the public consciousness. And then what happens is hippies take it over and suddenly they think that it means that, you know, what you think changes the universe and all of that sort of stuff, which it may do through your actions, but probably not through quantum mechanics.
It is kind of heady stuff, I guess. It's a little bit weird, but from the point of view of experimental physics, it really says that if you try to access certain properties, intrinsic properties of quantum particles, mm-hmm. right? So everything is quantum, but like you want to get to a point where the quantum nature of the particle is still intact, right? Mm-hmm. And you haven't transitioned to the classical, where it has collapsed, as we say, to one of its classical states. So if you really cool things down, mm-hmm. which means that you try to remove excitations, thermal excitations, things interacting with mm-hmm. your particle, then the less interactions, the more quantum that particle is or that object. So at that point, you can actually try to manipulate it using magnetic fields or like, you know, microwaves and things like that. And depending on which way you hit it from, you know, which direction in space you actually try to interact with it, you actually end up seeing different properties mm-hmm. of the same particle. And that's very interesting that you can actually measure the properties of a single thing from different points of view and end up getting different things.
So it, when we hear this thing, it depends on where you're observing it from. It's not necessarily where you're observing it from as the physicist in terms of like, oh, my eyes on. It's not like anthropology, right? Where by observing the thing, you change the behavior. It's
actually it is.
Okay.
it is exactly like that.
Okay.
So that's what's so interesting about it, that just like an anthropologist, you know, the moment you embed yourself into this social or anthropological experiment, you have to remember that you're part of the equation right now, right? So the moment you do that, there is this feedback.
Mm-hmm.
And so the very fact that you're actually interacting with something in order to observe it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like when we want to see something, we have to send photons to probe, right? The essence of that thing, okay? The inner properties, and then they have to bounce back,
right?
If they never came back, you have something like a black hole. So you can never really get what is happening inside a black hole because you never get any of that information coming out unless we have something called Hawking irradiation. But but that's kind of the idea that without interacting with something, you cannot know what it is.
And that's the Heisenberg uncertainty principle,
that's
right?
That's kind of exactly. It's part of that as well. That the moment that you actually ask, you know, one of these particles, what is your position? How would you know, right? You need to send a messenger,
right?
Some other particle, something like that interacts with it.
Mm-hmm.
But you want it to interact very weakly, because if it interacts very strongly, the interaction itself will actually change the position.
Right.
It's almost like you're trying to measure where a billiard ball is,
right?
But like if you really try to do it by sending another one to it, you will actually knock it off. So you want to send something much smaller, like a photon, right? That actually will bounce off of it, will not really change its state, and will come back in your eye and say, okay, it's right there.
Right. But even when you bounce a photon off of it, you do change it slightly.
It does change, yes.
Right.
But macroscopically, you cannot see this change. So there are some observables that for all intents and purposes, they have not been perturbed.
Right. Right. And I mean, the as I recall, and this is coming from high school physics, but the point of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle is that there's basically always a trade-off between knowing an object's momentum and knowing its direction and or position.
Position.
And the more certainly you know the position, the less certainty you have about the momentum and so on and so forth.
So this is interesting, I think, because this principle is actually a mathematical manifestation of a mathematical space on which we actually put the wave function. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So the wave function is this object, this mathematical object that has some coefficients, which are just some numbers, and they can be either real numbers or even imaginary or complex, which have both an imaginary and a real part. But these amplitudes, these coefficients, do not mean much by themselves. But when you square them, right, they are supposed to correspond to a probability of you finding yourself at that state.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this is interesting because, as we were saying earlier, there is a way to actually look at that one wave function from many different points of view, in what we call in mathematics many different bases, right?
Mm-hmm.
So just like you can decompose a vector, right, that is 45 degrees in the xy plane into equal parts in the x and the y plane, right? You could rotate your bases. Instead of having the xy bases, you could just rotate it any way you want and then decompose again that same vector that is fixed in space. And then it could have different components.
Mm-hmm.
So part of the game of actually understanding what's happening around us in the world is figuring out the right basis on which we can decompose these vectors, right?
Mm-hmm.
That you have all this information in the vectors. And if you're smart, you find the basis upon which the decomposition is very simple.
Mm-hmm.
In particular, if you were to rotate this xy plane 45 degrees, one of the axes would correspond to the direction of the vector itself.
Right.
So it would be along that direction, and then you wouldn't need to decompose in any other direction.
So just to take it back to billiard balls, right? So when we're talking about the vector is literally the line in which the billiard ball is moving.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah.
And we can break up that motion. So say it's moving, you know, across the table towards a corner pocket. Well, we can break that into a motion up the table and a motion to the left of the table,
exactly.
Right?
Yes.
But what you're saying is that if you rotate it so that instead of breaking it up like that, we break it up and one of the directions is pointing directly in the direction that the billiard ball is going,
yes.
Then it all becomes much, much simpler.
Exactly.
Right.
But there's a big advantage sometimes to doing the opposite of being kind of dumb and saying, well, I'm just going to decompose it along this x and y direction that I chose that has nothing to do with the
up
direction.
Up the table and to the
exactly.
left.
Exactly.
Right.
And the reason is because these become independent degrees of motion.
Mm-hmm.
And this is amazing, right? Mm-hmm. You know, when somebody first learned about Newtonian mechanics and projectile motion in college, right? Mm-hmm. They're fascinated with this idea that if you throw like a baseball, right, mm-hmm. with respect to some angle to the ground, you can actually figure out how far it's going to go and how high it's going to go, just mm-hmm. knowing like the strength of gravity, right? You know, and the initial velocity, and just mm-hmm. because you can actually figure things out independently in the X direction and in the Y direction,
right?
You know, going up and going to the right. So that's pretty interesting. But yes, this ability to decompose things mm-hmm. along different directions, as we say, independent degrees of freedom, as we call them, right? And I talked about that last time. This is very important because then you can do the analysis in each one of them. But that also gives you this amazing structure and also the potential of changing that basis, of changing your viewpoint, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the idea. Like, in particular, you can think of us being in three dimensions, right? And we always think of this XYZ mm-hmm. you know, planes, right, that we have like in three dimensions. But what if you were to rotate your head, mm-hmm. right? The world would look differently. Mm-hmm. And you have to do all the calculations in your head to move it back 90 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're like, okay, everything fits. But it would look very different to you than to somebody else, especially if you're hanging upside down. The world would look very different. You're like, this makes no sense. What are you talking about? Up is down and down mm-hmm. is up. So you have to do these transformations. But if you're hanging upside down, maybe you can do much better at interpreting something that you're seeing than
right.
if you're like just looking at it straight.
And this gets to, you know, why physicists and mathematicians often talk about math and physics and science being elegant, because you have to keep on changing your perspective, just like you would keep on changing your perspective on a chessboard.
That's right.
Until eventually you see the way forward.
Exactly. And this is actually where symmetries come in as well,
mm-hmm.
right? Because if you actually end up seeing the same thing as you're changing your basis of observation, right, your point of view, then you have a symmetry.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and symmetries are very powerful because they reduce like the complexity a lot. They're mm-hmm. saying in order for you to figure out how complex something is, you just have to look at it from one point of view, and then the symmetry will give you all the other points of view as well.
Mm-hmm.
That's very powerful.
And so let's talk about what some of those symmetries are, right?
Okay.
There's,
We have translational symmetry, right?
Mm-hmm.
We hope that the laws of physics mm-hmm. do not change as you move in space. You can do the same experiment, right, you know, here up in Andromeda Galaxy. You have some rotational symmetry, usually, that you can imagine, right? If you just like float in space and you start orbiting around like your center of gravity, then you should still be able to see the same experiments and the same answers. You also seem to have, in quantum mechanics, you actually have another symmetry that is time reversal symmetry.
Mm-hmm.
So the ability to actually go back in time and see the exact kind of like same things. The laws of physics should be exactly the same,
mm-hmm.
which is not something that... You know, when you look at the Newtonian world, right, this doesn't make much sense.
Right.
Okay? Because if you drop, like, you know, a cup of tea, it's going to break. But you don't expect if you, you know, you would expect gravity to always pull it down, but never, mm-hmm. like, push it up
right.
where it used to be, right, and make itself up. And this is one of these conundrums, I guess, right,
mm-hmm.
that we're trying to understand how in quantum mechanics you have this symmetry that the laws of physics are supposed to be the same forward or backward in time, but we see things differently. Right.
So there's, even though there should be that symmetry, there is some asymmetry, in the same way that even though there's symmetry between matter and antimatter, there's so much more matter than there is antimatter in the universe.
Yes, yes, yes. And we're trying to understand this through many different notions. One of them is spontaneous symmetry breaking, right?
Mm-hmm.
That for some reason, one of them becomes the object of choice, right? And the other one starts losing. And
mm-hmm.
the moment, like, you have... So you can think of it also from the point of view of stable and unstable equilibria,
mm-hmm.
right? So if you're like at the top of a hill and you drop a ball, right, or you just put it right there at the very top, just push it, it could like roll to the left or to the right. You don't know, right? It's very unstable.
Mm-hmm.
But if instead like you had a valley, it would always stay at the bottom. Doesn't
right.
matter what you do, it just come back. So one of them is a stable equilibrium, the other one is unstable. And then this spontaneous symmetry breaking has to do with this unstable symmetries, right, where you could like make the smallest input from something external would make immediately a choice for one or the other of, you know, the things that you had in your symmetry.
And that, one of the things that Dave Goldberg talks about here is it seems that in the very, there's a tiny, tiny, tiny preference for matter over antimatter. And then what happens is that when you're dealing with that many particles at the beginning of the universe, that essentially it ends up that the universe is overwhelmingly matter. Yeah, yeah,
yes.
yeah.
So it is, again, the same idea, right?
Yeah.
That, like, if, for some reason you're at a situation in parameter space, right, where after the Big Bang, say, mm-hmm. you know, you have all this huge explosion, and then you have this inflationary period where things are exponentially, like, fast, moving away from each other. But there is a point at which gravity starts to kick in, and then it starts to make, like, little clumps of matter, and then more and more and more. At some point, even though things are expanding, they're coming together as well, right? And you start creating actually, like, you know, galaxies, and then, like, all the things.
Solar systems,
exactly.
And stars and planets and the whole
thing. That's right.
Yeah,
if things were a little bit different, right, you know, or a little bit faster at expanding, okay, mm-hmm. or gravity was a little bit stronger, then you wouldn't actually see what we've seen, right? Because after the Big Bang, things would actually either collapse under mm-hmm. their own, like, gravity, back to nothing again, or that they would just keep expanding so fast that nothing would ever form.
Right.
So sometimes, you know, there is this question of fine-tuning, mm-hmm. right? How could it be that the expansion of the universe and the creation of, like, new space-time is at such a rate that is almost exact at what we need, right, you know, to actually see the things around us? And one of the ideas is that, well, if it weren't that way, we would not be here mm-hmm. to even ponder.
And right, that's called question. The anthropic principle.
That's right, that's the anthropic principle. But I've been thinking that there is something more fundamental than the anthropic principle.
Mm-hmm.
Because even if all of us are gone, mm-hmm. I talked about this last time, and we're wiped out like the dinosaurs, the universe, I think, like, would still keep going the way it's going, and, like, the Earth would still be there, and the other animals, potentially, or the cockroaches would still, like, rule the universe. But, you know, how is this possible, mm-hmm. right? Why is it the universe so fine-tuned? Maybe it was fine-tuned for cockroaches, not for humans, after all. Mm-hmm. But it's not. There's this ability of this universe, as long as it is stable, in a sense, right? And it can still, like, you know, have some predictive power mm-hmm. for its own future, right? Then it must be that this is a fundamental feature of this particular sequence of events, right? Or of this particular instantiation of different states of the universe. So there must be some more fundamental reason why you actually have this arrow of time, as we say, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is pretty interesting because, again, if you're trying to figure out how everything came to be
mm-hmm.
without any equations, right, without any external force, what would you call that, right? The things that we see around us are organized, right? There is, like, from chaos comes some order.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and it seems like, in some sense, increasing order.
That's right. So this concept is called self-organization,
mm-hmm.
right? And it has a lot to do with computer science mm-hmm. and biological systems, right? Mm-hmm. So it's been pretty interesting to see, up until very recently, up until 10 years ago, there was no definition, mathematical, like, precise definition for what it means for a system to exhibit self-organized behavior,
mm-hmm.
right? It was one of those things, like love. You know when you see it,
mm-hmm.
right? But now, it seems like about 10 years ago, some mathematicians, I think from the University of Michigan, and collaborated with somebody from Los Alamos National Labs, and they came up with this very nice definition that has to do with something called mutual information.
Mm-hmm.
And mutual information is literally this information you have. If you have a whole system and you can break it into two parts, right? If you were to just look at the two parts individually, you can just get some information about, you know, the system, right? But what if there are correlations between the two parts that actually end up giving even more information about the total, right?
So if there's emergent information.
Exactly. Just because you actually have these two parts,
mm-hmm.
right? But you put them together in a specific way, there is that information coming exactly from these two parts being glued together in that particular way. And that's this mutual information, the information that you have extra.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you were to just divide your system into two parts and just look individually, you would have some information. But what if there is any extra information? That's that mutual information.
Right. So it's if the whole is greater than the sum of its parts,
exactly.
then you have essentially
and
a self-organizing principle.
And this is pretty deep stuff.
Yeah.
Right? Why? Because if you think about human beings and, you know, the problem that, you know, something called the hard problem of consciousness,
mm-hmm.
okay, that has to do with qualia and this idea that, what do we feel the same way, right? You know, do we experience the world in the same way? And what actually makes up consciousness, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you put, like, a bunch of things that can be stimulated by the environment, right? Mm-hmm. You can have a thermostat or things like that, okay, that respond with respect to the environment. If you put a million of them together, will they be conscious,
mm-hmm.
okay? And it's the same question of dividing up the human mm-hmm. brain, for example, into all of its parts. Then you would think that, well, consciousness must be something more than just the sum mm-hmm. of all its parts, right? Of all the neurons and all this stuff. It is an emergent phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
It must be hiding in the collection, like, you know, of all these things and how they're actually correlated with respect mm-hmm. to each other. And I think a nice way to think of this is actually a Harry Potter book, right? Take all the words from yeah. the first book,
right?
And just, like, individually, and then just catalog them.
Mm-hmm.
Every word,
in
how many times
nice
it has
list.
Appeared.
Yeah.
Exactly. And, like, just go down. Maybe there's, like, you know, 10,000 different words that J.K. Rowling used, right? But this would mean nothing. If I gave you this list, this would not be the first book. It would not be popular at all.
Right. Right.
It'd be more like, you know, a lexicon or something like that. So mm-hmm. it is exactly how she puts it together.
Mm-hmm.
The plot, right? Mm-hmm. And how it all comes together that gives you this information. So it is the mutual information of the past pages to the next pages.
Right.
Of the past to the future. So mm-hmm. how much of the future depends on the past? Is that like in correlation, right?
Mm-hmm.
And to try to understand now the theory of everything from that point of view, how time and order emerges, you can actually think of it simply like a universe in which all these words, right, these particular states have been put together, just like the frames of a movie, in such a way so that the future depends on the past a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So the mutual information of the future with respect to the past is very high and it's increasing. So this could be the one that we've been looking for, right? That if you were to order together all these frames in mm-hmm. such a way so that at any point you can cut and say at minute like 35, right? What is the correlations, right? Or what we call the mutual information, which is mathematically precisely defined, of the future distribution to the previous distribution of all these frames, right? Then if this is large, it means that you actually have a good plot.
Right.
Okay, you haven't just introduced random elements in the future of the movie that
yeah.
have nothing to do with the past.
Okay, so to break this down a little bit more. Okay,
yes.
So for example, you know, I put a bunch of amino acids, a bunch of, you know, nucleic acids, a bunch of fats, a bunch of sugars in a jar. It
yes.
is not life.
No.
Right? It's that these things have to be arranged in such a way that their combination creates something greater
exactly.
than just that those parts, right?
And so it's being done also in a kind of a sequential way.
Yeah.
Right? It's what that's what evolution really is.
Right. Right?
You know, that there is a procedure upon which the smaller things end up making a little bit more complex
mm-hmm.
and more complex modules, and these modules come together, they create more complex modules and so on and so forth, right? Until you get something large. And then you're thinking to yourself, but how could it be? This is amazing, right? That like all these little things that have no intelligence on their own created something so intelligent afterwards.
So you're saying that the reason why time moves forward is because there's something fundamental about the universe that likes order to increase.
I wouldn't even say that. I would
yeah.
say that if this were not the case,
yeah.
right, this would not be our universe.
Right.
So if we were like, because I believe that all these other movies exist also, right, and
mm-hmm.
are playing out there. But if you're actually trying to figure out
mm-hmm.
what's happening in the next frame,
mm-hmm.
only a universe like ours allows you to do so.
Mm-hmm.
Because our universe has this mutual information increasing property to it,
mm-hmm.
right? And then you can predict the future
mm-hmm.
from the past. And this is actually, when you have a really good movie, in a sense, right, usually you think, oh, you already know what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Because you've seen kind of like this plot before, you can imagine they've set it up, unless there's a big twist, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is what science is doing as well, right? We are part of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And as time goes by, we're gathering more and more data. We're watching the movie, right? And as we're doing science, we're fitting more and more to the right parameters by figuring out what particles there are, the forces between them, and so on and so forth. And at some point, we will be able to actually see enough of the movie to say, okay, we can figure out the rest of it now. We don't actually have to watch anymore. We just have to figure out what's going to happen in the future, right? And this is, I guess, why I think the theory of everything has to have that ingredient in it. So it is fundamental in the sense that if it were not there, we would have no potential for predicting the future. And there is something else that is actually very important here. So it's not just your ability as a godlike creature to predict the future once you have like all these things. We are actually bounded, right? We have bounded resources, which means that our ability to predict the future should also be given through some bounded resource theory, meaning that you do not have an infinite amount of computational power, right? Mm-hmm. You should only be able to try to predict the future through some theory or equations that are very compressible, that can be written down very concisely in a sense. And if you don't have that, well, what are you going to do?
Right.
Right. So there are two aspects to trying to figure out the right theory of everything. The first is that it has to be able to be written down very concisely, right? Which is what we're trying to do, with no equations potentially.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second one is that it has to have predictive power.
Mm-hmm.
And so the notion that I was discussing earlier of this mutual information is called statistical complexity. And statistical complexity has to do exactly with this idea that, what is it that you need, right? How much information do you need to be able to predict the future given the past without actually being redundant, without using too much information from your past? Just the minimal amount you need to be able to predict the future.
Okay, so I think the first thing that's really important is, in terms of what you're saying about it should be something that's simple, that should be written down.
That's right.
There's something really, really, really important there, which I think in general gets overlooked. We look at the world and it seems more and more and more complex. And so I think a lot of people feel, the age of industrialization has taught us we can't possibly understand everything, yeah. Right? I have to try and understand how my job works. I don't also have time to try and understand quantum physics or campaign finance or any of these other issues.
Yes.
But what happens with, science, with all of these things, is that you find that actually things get simpler when you understand more, because it gets reduced down to a few core principles that you can apply across everything.
Precisely.
And so in physics, what you have is currently it's very messy. Because, you have four different forces. You have, thermodynamics, which applies at a sort of larger level. You have Newtonian mechanics, which applies at an even larger level. There's relativity. There's all these different things. And ultimately, what it would get to the stage is where you would have a single principle from which everything you would be able to derive and everything would emerge.
Through observations, you'd be able to just fit in to mm-hmm. that one principle, yes, and create the equations that you can use for specific regimes, right? For very large objects, very small objects, and so on and so forth. And that's precisely what I'd love to see happen, right? But I would say that physics actually has done a pretty amazing job at reducing the complexity of what used to be. It's just that you have two forces, right? One of them is an expanding force. The one that is because you're discovering so many new things, you're trying to fit that data also to your model. So you have to expand the model, and initially it looks more complex.
Right.
Because you have all these random points there. But then you do some good work, and then you expand your theory. Mm-hmm. Right. And that theory then explains not only what you already knew, but all the new data as well. And the nice thing, as you said, is that when that happens, when you're at that stage, your theory is much simpler than the original theory that actually described even fewer things.
Right.
So it's a win-win situation. And we hope to do even more, where you have fewer equations and you can explain even more things.
So, and an analogy that I think is, really accessible for people is, when Newton came up with, or really sort of synthesized together Newtonian mechanics. Initially, they had all these large complex charts for, the tides, and they had all these complex charts for the motion of the planets and all of this sort of stuff. And it was a bunch of equations. And ultimately what he realized is that all of this could be explained, the tides, the planets, the motions of the stars, by understanding gravity with a very small set of equations. And really, principally one, right? His universal equation for gravitation, right?
Yes.
So the same thing is what happens. That is the process of physics. Even if you look in, evolution, coming from the biological sciences, there's, this diversity of life. It all seems so crazy. How do you explain why this bird is this way and this other bird has this different beak? And then you realize, oh, it's a single thing, right? That's change through time because the survival of the fittest or whatever, simplification you want to use. But it becomes much, much easier to understand all of that life through that one lens.
Yes.
And so what we should really be doing as individuals is not shying away from something like quantum physics because we think it's too hard for us, or, that it's reserved for, Greek gods. But in fact, we should really be engaging with it, because it's actually understanding these things is not going to cost us time.
Yes.
It's going to save us time.
Yes.
Because we'll have these core principles that we can apply broadly across many areas of life.
That's right. And I think also that the human intelligence, right, shies away usually from things it thinks it doesn't understand,
mm-hmm.
right? And it is, I wouldn't say it really is our fault as physicists or mathematicians that have created so many arcane equations and so many, like, you know, deep concepts there. But we have a responsibility to the public to make it accessible at a level where they can engage with them, you know, themselves with these concepts without having to learn all these equations. Because in the end, I really do believe that you should be able to explain the theory of everything to a 10-year-old kid, right? That is just, you know, can stay there for like an hour and then just ask questions back and forth and say, okay. Because every time a kid asks you this question, why, right? It's because you do not know the answer,
mm-hmm.
right? They don't know the answer, but what they have on top of you is that they have this curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
And that you may think you know the answer, right? Because you thought that you learned about it, or you thought a bit about it, and you said, yes, that's, you know, that's why. But then if they keep asking you why, it gets really annoying, not just because they are asking you why and they're not letting you do what you want to do, but because they make you realize that you're actually missing something,
mm-hmm.
right? And you were a kid at some point yourself, and you thought, like, you know, why is that?
Mm-hmm.
Why is there time? Apparently, mm-hmm. my nephew just recently asked my brother, what is a minute? What is time? Right? He's 3 years old, right?
Yeah.
So my brother, of course, asked me to try to come up with a theory of everything within the next year to explain that. It should be fun.
Yeah.
But I think there is a lot of value,
mm-hmm.
In actually reaching out to the public and getting everyone engaged with these questions, because they're not just questions about physics, right? They're questions about life at large, right? Our purpose, how much we can figure out, right? What we're made of, these kind of things. And the very process, the journey itself, I think, is far more important than actually figuring out the answers, you know? So I would like to see a lot more kids,
mm-hmm.
You know, engage with these questions, a lot more of their parents, actually. And we're trying to do things to make it a little bit easier, because without the template,
mm-hmm.
then where do they start, right? You pick up like a book on quantum mechanics and say, okay, I'm going to read like the first two chapters and go talk to like my 12-year-old son or daughter.
Right.
It's going to be tough. So.
Well, and I mean, the interesting, a lot of the stuff that's been going on in physics teaching, people like, you know, Spiros and I were introduced through a friend of mine from college, Alexei Gorshkov. And, you know, Alexei, who is also a quantum physicist, was talking about Eric Mazur, who is the guy responsible for the flipped classroom and some of the work that's being done in physics teaching, because what they're realizing is that the problem is that even that if you want to become a physicist, then you have to get to those simplifications, because it's having simple models that frees your mind up to be able to, you know, see the larger patterns and all that sort of stuff.
Exactly. And yeah. This is interesting because, again, as I said last time, actually I have a PhD in mathematics,
mm-hmm.
mathematical physics, as it's called. But my first mentor, Matthew Hastings, one of the most important things he taught me was that I should let go of this notion that I have this like super powerful brain that can immediately see the big picture and the generalization of everything,
mm-hmm.
right? I should just start working with the very smallest model I can make to actually get some idea of what direction the truth lies in, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then if you do that, it's actually not so easy,
mm-hmm.
to create your own little example that can actually give you some non-trivial information without having to go, you know, all the way, right? It's almost like trying to prove a very deep mathematical theorem, and you're trying to just say, okay, you know, you could start with the Pythagorean theorem, for example, before it was known, right? And then you draw a bunch of triangles, and every time you see this pattern, and then from there, you can try to deduce that it is always true, a squared plus b squared equals like c squared, right? So we need more of that. We need to build more physical intuition,
mm-hmm.
With respect to the public. And in order to do that, we need to give them some of these models and some of these questions, like puzzles, right? Because the public is much smarter than we give it credit for, right? Very, very deep thinkers out there that just are waiting, right, to just see the right picture. And then they already have the emotional connection, or like poetry, you know, they've already like, you know, experienced some things, and then they completely immediately unlock, right, the depth of the poem. And here we are trying to see it from our point of view, which is like, you know, tens of years of exercising with specific mathematical tools. And then you forget, as a mathematician or a physicist, that all of your work and the way you're trying to approach things is presupposing all these assumptions, right? And your viewpoint is kind of stuck in one way. But on a different side note, if you are a good physicist, or if you are a good mathematician or a good scientist, then the thing that you try to, it's kind of like you exercise every day. If you're like, you know, the UFC, right? You mm-hmm. have to always be ready. So what do you have to do? You have to do your push-ups, your crunches, right? You have to do your weights and all that stuff, spar with others. So we try to spar with ourselves and say, okay, you're getting kind of like your muscles are atrophying, mm-hmm. or maybe they're not expanding, right? Because you keep thinking the same direction.
Right.
So start doing things differently. Right. You know, use different muscle groups to grow and so on and so forth. And then you start seeing the world from many different points of view. And then they start making sense, because if they're all supposed to represent the same truth, it has to be something deeper that connects all of them.
Right. And this goes back to your earlier point about the chess, because ultimately, you know, I mean, Nassim Nicholas Taleb has written a lot about this, mm-hmm. with the Black Swan. You know, yes. Whenever you get an expert community, they get blinded, they get a certain way of thinking about things. And that's why you really need the wisdom of the crowds, because whether it's, you know, a child, or it's a guy in his 20s who, you know, just enjoys doing this in his spare time, yeah. or it's a retiree who is now that's doing right. this. You know, this is their avocation. This is what they're going to spend all their free time doing. They're going to have, because of their life experience, a totally different perspective. And they're going to ask, you know, new questions that professionals will not think to ask. And they'll come up with new solutions.
Yes. And there is something else that happens. And I just realized as I was working on this, you know, the emergence of time myself, that sometimes even within the scientific community, right, you're thinking, oh, the physicists have the answers, or will have the answers for all this stuff, right? You just have to look at the physicists. But I'm seeing more and more that the mathematicians have a big role to play. Mm-hmm. The philosophers have a very big role to play, right? The computer scientists, for their own reasons, without even realizing, they're developing like theories and definitions, like this statistical complexity, that without even knowing may end up like helping a lot in defining this arrow of time, right? Mm-hmm. That originally physicists thought, okay, it's the thermodynamic arrow of time. As the entropy increases, this is why there is a direction in time. But what if there is a more fundamental reason, right? Something that is an even better reason than just this thermodynamic increase. And so you don't realize it, but like all the scientists around the world, they're doing their own work and they're thinking it's just like, you know, for this small part of the world, of the scientific world. But maybe they're unlocking huge secrets. Mm-hmm. They're just waiting for somebody to just use it, right? Somebody who just needed that, and then it's right there waiting. Boop. And it doesn't have to be just in math. It can be like across different disciplines. And that's pretty exciting.
It should be. I mean, that's the thing. So Innocentive was this website, I think, that was set up by Eli Lilly, because they realized mm-hmm. there were certain problems that, you know, no matter who they put on it, no matter how much time and money they put in, they couldn't solve.
Yeah.
So they made these problems open and available to anybody to solve. And the interesting thing was that the people who solved these problems were almost never in the field in which the problem mm-hmm. was. It was always somebody who was in an adjacent field, or who had enough knowledge, like enough basic knowledge, to be able to see the inside or whatever
right.
it was.
That's
and
right.
what doesn't happen enough in science, and what needs to happen a lot more, is that cross-pollination, that interdisciplinary work, because everybody gets siloed in their own weird little field. And the problem is that the people who can actually solve the problem, I mean, in education, for example, you know, the people who can really solve the problem, frankly, are pop stars and musicians and, you know, movie stars, because the people whose minds need to be changed are the kids. They think school is stupid and a waste of time, and the people who are going to convince them otherwise are the people they already listen to.
That is true, actually. That's very true, because usually you would not think of a pop star as being the best role model for you know, for educational reform, but they have definitely the reach,
yeah.
right? And this is what you need. And then if you start... adiabatically, slowly turning mm-hmm. your message, right, from something that does not have like much depth to something that has a little bit of depth and like, you know, starts making you think more, mm-hmm. but like, oh wait, what was that? Then you really can get something good out of it. So I definitely agree with that. Yeah,
and there's so many fun ways to do it. I mean, for, you know, I'm not going to ask you when you were born, but for anybody who is a child of the 80s.
I am 1980, so
there you go.
Yeah.
Jackpot.
Proud of 1980s.
Right. And I mean, it's amazing. Like, you know, people from the 80s, most of them know, a lot of them know the word plethora. Mm-hmm. And the reason why we know the word plethora is because we saw the Three Amigos.
And I'm Greek, so yeah.
Well, there you go. You have an advantage. But that's the thing is that, you know, I mean, so much of this stuff is that, you know, I mean, that's a hilarious scene. But if you weave that stuff in clever, fun ways, that's you end up teaching people and you give them the base where they then feel comfortable enough and they feel like the stuff is accessible. And then they're willing to go on, right? It's the, you know, the hardest step is always that first step.
So there is definitely the aspect of, you know, who are the kids listening to, mm-hmm. right? But even when the kids are on their own or when they're playing with each other, they're playing games,
mm-hmm.
right? So you do want to work with games as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, I did some work with Google to implement quantum mechanics, right? And some of the concepts of quantum mechanics within the game of Minecraft.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in the beginning, I wasn't sure how this was going to go.
Mm-hmm.
All I knew was that I loved playing video games as a kid with my brothers. And, you know, when you have Google on your side, right, mm-hmm. you could pretty much do like anything. You have your unbounded resources pretty much. And they have a lot of enthusiasm. So it was really great. Because they had the connection already with the creators of Minecraft and also with the developers of Minecraft EDU, the educational mm-hmm. aspect of Minecraft. And this is exactly what we were saying earlier, that you have something that's like, you have rock stars, right? And in YouTube right now, you have all these huge celebrities with millions of followers, and many of them actually have to do with Minecraft, where they actually play the game, they record themselves, and then like all these kids, millions of kids, just watch it and like it and all this stuff. So you could really get in there and teach the public, and in particular kids. And I didn't realize at the time. I thought maybe like 13 and up, mm-hmm. right? That's what I thought. But like, shows how old I've gotten, like, you know, since I was playing video games. But I was at the convention mm-hmm. Back in November, the MineCon, as it's called, in Florida. And we had a huge booth there, right, for QCraft, which is the mod that we developed for the game Quantum Craft. And we had thousands of kids. Thousands of kids come and like play, stay there. We only allowed them like 10-15 minutes each because there were so many of them. But they would go to their parents and say like, okay, so what is quantum entanglement? And, you know, mm-hmm. where can I find out more about quantum superposition? And I remember seeing like grandmas with their like granddaughters, right? Mm-hmm. And they're just focusing there and say, okay, could you teach me how to play this with my granddaughter? I'm like, here you go, and you do this and all mm-hmm. that stuff. So it was very interesting to see this connection, this human connection. And also to see the kids themselves just like become so interested in something that in any other context, you would never even expect them to take a second look, right? And they would not be able to peel their eyes off of like the screen. It was amazing. So we hope to do things like that, like in other respects as well.
It is amazing, but I think that's the interesting thing is that in some senses it's not. And the reason why is because what you've done is you've actually just engaged with people's humanity. Like there are things that people like to do. There are, you know, human psychology has certain biases. And I think for so long we've just ignored what human beings are.
That's right.
And just sort
you
of
teach a machine.
Like, yeah,
you know,
exactly.
That's what you're saying. Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing is that, you know, the interesting thing is, you know, the National Academy of Sciences has this huge document. It's like 700 pages. Mm-hmm. And it's all about, you know, how people learn. And the big, big, big conclusion is that it's about metacognition, which mm-hmm. is just thinking about thinking.
Yes.
In other words, if you want to learn, you have to be thoughtful.
Yes.
And the what most of the inverted commas learning that happens is thoughtless. It's, mm-hmm. you know, people aren't thinking about the physics. They're
That's
just
right.
memorizing the equation. They're not really relating it to their life. They're not forming any sort of connection with
yes.
it. They're not saying, oh, does this actually fit my experience?
Because have you ever heard like a kid who's reading Harry Potter say like, oh, mom, do I need to know the next page for the test? That would just never happen, right? They're like, I can't wait. I'm just going to read the next chapter and go to sleep. And then you lie and you read the whole book, right?
Right.
You know, you stay up until like 4 in the morning.
Or make flashcards for like Horcrux,
<That's>
Horcrux.
Exactly. So you want to That's right. I mean, it is about the humanity. You want to put the kids at that space, right, in the zone mm-hmm. where I remember seeing them when I was at the convention, that there's all these things happening around them. But when they were in the game, they were in the zone, right? Mm-hmm. They would work like at a level of intelligence and expertise that scared me. Okay, mm-hmm. And I've only seen when, you know, my friends would play Warcraft or Starcraft, I guess, during college. And this is amazing because when you're at that level, you're very thoughtful. You're very concentrated. Mm-hmm. Okay, and you're thinking of every move that you're making. This is not just random, you know, moves that you're doing. So I do believe that a good story, and I brought that up last time, is probably the best way to teach someone something and make them emotionally connected so that even when you disappear, that story will remain and they will do their darnestest to learn more mm-hmm. and like further that story. They will want to know what comes afterwards.
Right.
So I want to see more of that. And in that respect, I've been doing a little bit more work with Jorge Cham, the creator of PhD Comics, uh-huh. which is pretty much the equivalent of Dilbert, but for academia. Right? Uh-huh. It's pretty hilarious. And I asked him from the beginning, I want you to do some animations for us, mm-hmm. right? To actually, you know, go out there in the public and say, this is the work we're doing at Caltech, for example, at the Institute for Quantum Information and Matter. We're doing all these amazing experiments, right, that are like pushing what we know about quantum mechanics mm-hmm. and about the universe, really, right? And how do you do that? You could just do a talk and record it, right? Or you could just write a textbook. But who is going to, you know, how many people are going to read that and yeah. even, like, you know, get it? So from this flipped classroom idea as well, I had learned from Salman Khan that you just need something that's about 5-6 minutes long and engages, right, mm-hmm. the public. And I did one with John Preskill. We have three of them already done, three animations. But that one got like close to 300,000 views. I'm more popular because of that than any theorem I will ever prove. Right? You know? This is just like about quantum computers.
Yeah.
Right? So we need more things like that.
And I think that's the thing is that those questions already exist in the public's mind. There are things that we hear about all the time and we're like, what does that mean? I would love to know more about that.
Exactly.
And that's the thing. The curiosity is already there. It just needs to be satisfied.
Yes, yes.
And that is what you're doing.
I hope so.
So, I mean, I think that's the thing, you know, for me, I was so excited to have you on because I, you know, had, to be perfectly honest, I was intimidated by this stuff and figured that in some sense it was either beyond, I don't know that I thought that it was beyond me in terms of my capacity to understand. Because
it was on purpose, Hunter. It's better to be feared than to be loved.
That's right. That's right. But there are so many great resources out there if you want to go out there and, you know, learn about
yes.
this stuff. And why would you miss out on what is frankly fascinating stuff, because these are such fundamental questions. Whether you play QCraft, which Spiros helped develop, whether you read The Universe in the Rearview Mirror by Dave Goldberg, or whether you watch these animations that you're talking about. And where can we find those animations?
You can find them on our website at quantumfrontiers.com mm-hmm. and also on phdcomics.com/quantum.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Spiros Michalakis, thank you. Evcharisto.
Thank you so much for having me again, Hunter.
Yeah.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.